You have reached the Vantage Point with Michael Vail. Expanding horizons, elevating perspective, engaging today's leaders from fields as diverse as geopolitics, law, medicine, and technology. In penetrating interview and debate, allowing you to see all the forces that shape events around the world.
Welcome to another live edition of The Vantage Point, courtesy of StratRisk and CorbettReport.com. On with me tonight is James Corbett from TheCorbettReport.com. James is an independent journalist who has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He has been writing and producing The Corbett Report, an online multimedia news and information source, since 2007. His forthcoming book, Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, will be available for purchase later this year. James Corbett, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure and an honor.
And I've been following you for a while now, and really the work you've been doing. Lay that out for us real quick.
All right. Well, I am absolutely honored to be working with some incredible people who I've sort of befriended along the way, and kindred spirits, I guess, that I've met along the path of finding out about this information. So I guess one of the first up was Richard Andrew Grove, who a lot of people might remember from the Eighth Estate. And he had a very, very interesting and popular lecture talking, it's called Project Constellation, talking about his own experiences with 9/11 and some of the behind the scenes things that were happening there. He's also got tragedyandhope.com, which is now sort of a conglomeration of some independent media producers. So I was lucky enough to be in on that pretty much since the beginning of Tragedy and Hope. And then I was in touch with Sibel Edmonds, the FBI whistleblower of boilingfrogspost.com. And she's got me as part of her team that she's assembling, an incredible team of some media producers again. And I'm doing a weekly video series for that. There's Global Research, the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca. I'm the video producer for GRTV. And so I'm doing interviews and videos and short headline type segments for GRTV. And as you say, I'm with James Evan Pilato, MediaMonarchy.com, where we do a weekly video series called New World Next Week. And I've got a lot of other things on the go at all times. So you're right. It is an incredible amount of stuff to keep together. But it's really what I do. It's what I live, breathe, eat, and sleep, because to me, this is the only thing that really matters.
Well, I mean, that's what it is. You know, a lot of us do a lot of this work, and you know, the money that we give either based on donations or what we can make. And really, it's not about that. It's sort of like a fervor for the truth, you know, searching for the truth, searching for facts, information, and the little bits of juicy bits of information that you can find and put together and form your own thesis and ideas. You said that you're working on a documentary project regarding China-U.S. relations. Talk a bit about that.
That's right. This is the Center for Research on Globalization, again, globalresearch.ca, funded a trip for me out to China, to Beijing, to go and talk with some people out there, some scholars, writers, thinkers, and people who are well known in China, but probably have never heard of them outside of China. So I did that for a week last week. I got some footage around Beijing and the Great Wall and things like that, and I got to talk to some interesting scholars about some of the China-U.S. relations and some of the things surrounding that. So talking about the economy, talking about obviously the geopolitical tensions taking shape right now between China and the U.S., and also talking about the cultural imperialism, which is another part of the entire imperial game that doesn't get as much attention because it's not quite as flashy as the idea of military conflict or the ins and outs of the economic relations.
But it's about as important as you know, military relations, you know, and really most people don't see that because China and their one China policies and such, you know, they're so dominant in the media and relations with Taiwan and Tibet, but their own people are going through a hard time right now, and you know, running up to Mao Zedong and all of that. So that'll be good. I'll look forward to seeing that. You're a busy
guy. So do I, but it's going to be a lot of work, I think.
I can imagine.
Well, a lot of the interviews were actually in Chinese, which I myself don't speak. I was getting some translation, but now I have to go and get them properly, professionally translated. So it'll be a few weeks before it's really together, but it should be some pretty interesting stuff.
Well, that's good. You're going directly, you know, into the mouth of the beast, and really getting it done. I wanted to talk about the real quick as we switch gears. Talk about the terrorist groups now, as we have a war on terrorism, supposedly. Yet it seems that we're on pretty friendly relations with terrorists. You look in Libya, you had Lakhdar Taiba from Pakistan working, and you know, basically the rebels in Libya, Al-Qaeda, was in Libya. So now there's all this talk about Al-Qaeda in Syria. What's your thoughts on that, and really the sort of process of how we are on having a war against terror, but yet we fund and really push the terrorists, really going back to Executive Order 12333, Operation Cyclone, and the rest of it.
Exactly right. Well, as you say, I mean, this has a long and rich history, so this should come as no surprise to people who have been paying attention to this for any length of time and know about Operation Cyclone and how the West really created and funded and stirred up these Muslim groups. And if you go to, for example, my documentary, Al-Qaeda Doesn't Exist, which is also available at alqaedadoesntexist.com. There, I have some footage in there of Zbigniew Brzezinski, of course, National Security Advisor to Carter, out there in Afghanistan saying, you know, your fight is for God and you will win because you have God on your side. And, you know, they're all clapping and applauding politely because here they are, the Americans stirring up this Islamic hornet nest, and we just didn't know what was going to happen, the old blowback theory. But of course, as you say, there's a long history of this, so it shouldn't really come as a surprise that there's a marriage at the very top between these forces and the people that are puppeteering them. And yet more indications of that have come out in recent months, including a startling story that I did cover a little bit at the time, but I think didn't get enough attention. From Tony Cartolucci at Land Destroyer Report, who does excellent work. And he had a story about U.S. troops guarding terrorist camps in Iraq. And again, you just can't make this up. As the U.S. was pulling out of Iraq, they were also simultaneously making a deal with this organization, the MEK, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, to let them have some of the bases that they were abandoning. And again, this is fully admitted terrorist organization that now some bigwigs and heavyweights in the American political establishment are coming out and literally lobbying for them to get delisted, including of course Giuliani and people like Congressman Lewis and former FBI Director Louis Free and all of these.
Giuliani is involved in this.
Absolutely, it's
Mr. Terror, Mr. Terror Giuliani.
Yeah, America's mayor, right? Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, God. Excuse me while I puke here for just a second. You know, really, most people who don't look into the history of all this and see things at face value, then they are terrorists. And they are terrorists to a large degree, but they're used properly. I was doing a bit of research into the Muslim Brotherhood and how MI5, MI6 was really sort of shepherding them. Back in, I think it was basically 1973, actually 1954, when I talked to you about earlier on your show about Gamal Abdel Nasser and his getting in the Straits of Tehran, doing the same thing Iran is doing today. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood was basically being used by the CIA to attack pro-Nasser students, pre-terror attack days, you know, before it was really a big thing. And even in Syria, during 1973, Jordan and Israel supporting the Muslim Brotherhood against Syria. So,
Exactly right, and that's the political calculus that's going on here. I mean, we could literally sit here for all day and give examples of this organization or that organization being secretly funded and it eventually coming out by the West. But the point of all of these different operations is that they're always stirring up opposition to whatever regime that they don't want in whatever country, as we see happening in Syria now. We saw it in Libya last year. We've seen it, for example, Nasser's Egypt. We've seen it in time after time, and generally against strong secular governments. They'll whip up the Islamic element in order to get people motivated to start bombing campaigns and to destabilize governments that they don't like. Of course, slightly different in the Syrian calculus because of the rather strange political calculus that goes on with the different religious sects there. But still, it's essentially the same thing, trying to whip up the religious elements, the religious extremists, to take on these governments. So it's really just a sword for Western imperialist tendencies. And we see them drawing that sword from its sheath every single time that they need to destabilize one of those governments in that area.
It's an interesting game plan. I mean, you know, after some terror attacks, sniper attacks, and bombings, well, you say, okay, the country is completely destabilized for the sake of, an old international relations theory, the responsibility to protect R2P. You can invoke the NATO Charter and all this sort of coming to the fore, where you can say, well, oh, it's gone completely out of hand. These guys can no longer control their country anymore. We must intervene. And it goes right along with the geopolitical playbook, and it's played out in many niches.
That's right. And to a certain extent, you have to actually admire the people behind the scenes who are doing this insofar as they're able to pull these things off time and time again. And no matter how out in the open it is or how exposed it is, they still manage to get away and get most of the public behind their operations. So we saw, obviously, in the Bush era, it was a more overt kind of we're just going to go and bomb them to oblivion because they attacked us kind of thing. But of course, now that the public opinion is mellowed somewhat, and it's now a leftist regime in power, and you know, I put that in quotation marks, they just need a different founding ideology for their wars of conquest. So now they have R2P, they have these color revolutions, they have the Twitter revolutions and things like this, WikiLeaks starting these revolutions and all these different things that they've done. But of course, again, they're just following game plans that have been honed by people like Gene Sharp of the Albert Einstein Institute and things, as has come out quite thoroughly in the alternative media. But again, I marvel at how ultimately so many people continue to go along with these wars, and people from the exact opposite end of the spectrum who were so against Bush are now think all of these wars are great, wonderful things for the liberation of all these poor people. And of course, let's not actually go back to Libya and look what's happened since that.
Oh, God.
Since the Gaddafi government went down.
It's gotten a lot worse. I mean, you just about have civil war. Now, some rebels are aligning, you know, some are separating. And really now you don't know what's going to happen in Libya. You know, time will tell. But like you said, you know, it's a big game plan. They've been doing it for many different years. You know, to hear Al-Qaeda, you know, being in Syria, for what purpose? You know, it's not like Syria is some secular nation that they want to, you know, really attack for some purpose. And most people don't know that Al-Qaeda, from the root Arabic word Al-Qaeda, which means the root, the base, it can also mean the toilet, the mound, basically where you drop your poop in the desert. what do you think is really going to happen with Syria? Things are really, really taking a bad shape.
They really are, and it's obviously a tense time right now. I just see things unfolding so similarly to Libya, and we see the same international things taking shape, even down to the point of back in August of last year, even as Libya was still being bombed and things had not really settled yet one way or another. They had already started their, I believe they call it the Libya Contact Group or something like that was meeting in Turkey at the time in August to basically divvy up the country before it was even finished with. And now we see this Friends of Syria group that's going to be meeting in Saudi Arabia.
I was just going to mention that. Friends of Syria. Friends.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's
like the Free Syria Army and all of these other things. Of course, it's all about the optics and it's all about the rhetoric and the little labels they put on things, exactly like the Patriot Act and all of these other things. But they use it because it's effective.
Democracy.
Oh yes, our old friends at NED. Yes.
Yeah, but they have nice names, and they seem to be an upstanding members of society in their NGOs. Recently, Bahrain said that that a number of NGOs are trying to basically stir up the dust. And I always wanted to ask you this question. When it comes down to, like, basically ham and eggs, or eggs versus bacon, Syria or the USA, what do you think is the main problem with a lot of people who take sides in the debate instead of sort of, you know, looking at the information and seeing how it plays out? Do you think there's a lot of people sort of picking sides on this when really it's not necessary? We need to be exposing it instead of, you know, basically being a cheerleader for one side or the other?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that's something that a lot of people can't understand even when you approach it from this angle, because a lot of times when I'm pointing out some of the ludicrousness of the propaganda that goes into, for example, demonizing Syria and trying to make some sort of case for military intervention there, when you point out the stupidity of that, people will assume that you are somehow defending the Assad government, or that you don't care what's happening to people in Syria or things like that, which of course is completely wrong. But it's the exact same way that, for example, when I was trying to point out some of the bad, the disgusting, terrible, horrible abuses of the Bush regime, everyone thought I was some kind of commie lefty. And now that I have tried to point out the horrible abuses of the Obama regime, I'm a horrible rightist, you know, fascist. And it's that paradigm that they get people into. And you're exactly right. It's cheerleading. They get you to vote for one side or the other.
Slogan.
That's the way they get you. Exactly. People invest their identity in that game, and it does become like a sporting event or anything else where you start to pick sides. And I find myself getting drawn into that sometimes, because it's an incredibly powerful tool for manipulating people's perception of the world, and therefore what they're capable of perceiving. It's not just shaping the debate, but shaping the way people can think about a subject, which is so much more insidious. But you're exactly right. I think they get you to think of, oh, this is, you know, the West versus the East, or this is, you know, the US versus Syria. But no, absolutely, you're right. People should not be picking sides in this. The fundamental point of something, for example, like the Syria, the question of military intervention in Syria, is does Syria have a national I don't know what to say, right, or the auto-determination that any other state has, to the point where it was a Syrian, I believe the Syrian ambassador in the UN was saying, well, we're not going to be sending troops to protect the Occupy Wall Street protesters. Is exactly the point, isn't it? I mean, how on earth can we make that justification that, oh yes, UN peacekeepers should go to Syria to try to stop the violence there, when if it was suggested in the United States, people would laugh at it on its face. And I think for good reason, because the idea of sending an international goon squad in to try to, you know, take sides in what is essentially an internal conflict is ridiculous. It's terrible, and it will only end in bad things, as I think a lot of people out there know, but it's hard to get that message across to people who have picked one side or another in that cheerleading debate.
I like to call it fractionalization, or, you know, looking through things through a prism. You know, basically you get broken up and you get placed in a little box, and you only see things with little horse blinders on, and it's sad. And I see our own, you know, investigative journalists out there, you know, doing the same thing and falling in the trap. And like you said, it's hard. It's hard, really. Because I have been called a neocon, I've been called a liberal, depending on who's in office, and really, you know, I have basic principles. I'm about freedom. I'm not about liberty, because liberty is basically freedoms minus what society wants you not to do. So, you know, it's really about what the good of their country, you know, what really should happen for them. Not really, you know, geostrategic interests and values, and what can we get out of this? And really, you know, how long have you been doing investigative journalism, and how did you get into it, and what really moved you to start this and move forward in a big way?
Well, the website was started in 2007, and I really began the research for what became the website really only in 2006. And there were a few things that prompted me along the way. I think the thing that really started me along this path was investigating into 9/11 and some of the things that we hadn't been told about that, and the greater backstory, and all of the shenanigans that were going on, not just on that day, obviously, but all the things surrounding that day and the people who were involved on that day, and the Giulianis and all of that information. So once I fell down that rabbit hole, as they say, I certainly that was what really motivated me. But I realize now that I was kind of being mentally prepared by a number of events that had happened to me in the preceding years that really showed me just the extent to which we were already facing just really fundamental changes to our society. And that included once when I was here in Japan and I was heading back to Canada for my friend's wedding. And at the time, I had a little beard, and I've quickly discovered, if you have a beard and you're traveling by yourself from Japan to Canada, you're going to get stopped at customs. And it was absolutely one of the most just unbelievable events to me, because it wasn't just getting stopped at customs and them going through my bag. It was them asking me all sorts of questions that I didn't even know what my rights were. I didn't know whether I could say no. So they were going through my phone and taking a look at the pictures and asking me who each person was and why I didn't have so many pictures on my phone. Jeez. On camera. And they went through my diary and they asked if they could photocopy it and things like this. It was just so amazing to me that really started to open my eyes. And then I was actually watching the Gandhi, the movie with what's his name, Ben Kingsley as Gandhi. And it was one of the scenes in that movie that for whatever reason really struck me is when he led in South Africa, he was leading the Indians who had to carry their identity cards. And it was a huge protest, and him and many other people burnt their identity cards in protest of the British. And that was one of the first times he got imprisoned for his political activism and started him along his path. And it struck me sitting there watching that, here I was in Japan with my little foreigner card in my pocket, as you are required to carry around with you at all times here, or you can be taken down to the police station and interrogated for hours. So, and I was sitting there thinking, that's something that I didn't even think about. I didn't like, I just thought, oh, well, that's the rule, you got to do it. And then I'm watching this movie and seeing this is something fundamental about being a free human being on this planet, that people in former days were willing to be thrown in jail and stage protests and do things about. And in our day and age, we just accept it. And unfortunately, things just keep getting worse and worse along that way. And it really is a process of conditioning that we've been going through for a long time. So that was me snapping out of that and starting to question what was happening. And I think once you get into that, it's not very hard to see that we're definitely being led along a wrong path. And we have been for some time now.
Well, yeah, and one of your shows, it's called Overcoming Learned Helplessness, and you mentioned an experiment in here. Talked about how dogs could be conditioned into accepting electric shocks, even when they were easily avoidable. There was another experiment done on rats, where when the rats were shocked, eventually, over a period of time, they didn't blame the person who was shocking them. They attacked others around them. Do you think that our society, of course, being also conditioned, but do you think that the sort of heightened level of fear is really shutting down people's mentality from seeing people, things for what they really are? I mean, you think of like terrorism. It's either you're either with us or you're against us, or you're with Al Qaeda. Do you think that sort of mentality leads to a shutting down of the mind?
Oh, there's absolutely no question about it. I mean, I think the way that that we've been programmed for quite a long time now, but certainly in this age of terror, is to expect these big dramatic events that take place on the geopolitical stage, and I use that word advisedly. And we're shown these events almost like we are watching some sort of play or something, and we see the way it unfolds on the nightly news, and it is this narrative that takes shape, and the inevitable outcome of this narrative is, oh well, we must now give up our freedoms at the airports and let TSA molest us and things like that. It becomes the end point of this narrative, and I think people do get invested in that with their identities, with their perceptions, with their worldviews, and it's something that I think absolutely is a predictable result of the way that people have been shocked, metaphorically in this sense by different events, and that concept of learned helplessness is so fascinating. It was one that came up in the 1960s. From an experiment conducted by Martin Seligman and some of his colleagues, that was interesting because it really overthrew some things that had been taken for granted through the the progression of Pavlovian conditioning and the idea you ring the bell, you can make a dog salivate. And then B.F. Skinner in America took that a step further with his behaviorism. And he had the Skinner box where he could train pigeons to peck or to turn on command in order to get their food. And so it was this idea. And Skinner actually wrote this this utopian novel called Walden 2. Yeah, where he came up with this perfect place where the scientists could basically condition everyone basically from birth into being these perfect automatons who would act in virtuous ways because they'd been conditioned to, and so the society would be harmonious. And I think that was really an ideal that social engineers had for quite a while and was represented quite well there. But then this learned helplessness experiment seemed to turn that on its head because they were trying to condition this dog to be scared of a certain stimulus that was associated with the electric shock. But the weird thing was, because in the conditioning phase, they had the dog restrained, so it couldn't move when it was being shocked. It just had to sit there and take it. And then when they put it in this setup where all it had to do was jump over this tiny little fence, it could do it easily in order to escape the shock. But it didn't even try to do it because it had been conditioned to think, well, there's nothing I can do. I just got to sit here and take it. So it just sat there and took the shocks, whereas a dog that hadn't been conditioned would just easily jump over that fence. And in the exact same way, it really does apply to humans as well, as subsequent experimentation and practice showed that humans also have this learned helplessness where they can literally be conditioned into accepting a type of worldview in which whatever's happening is happening because that's the way it is and nothing can change it. And so we just have to take it. And so when we see these grand scale events, these 9/11s and these Lehman Brothers and all of these big events that people feel absolutely powerless over, it is that demotivation. And it pervades this sense that all you can do is sit there and take it and be happy for the scraps that they occasionally give you from the table. And we have to encounter that because it is something that truly can be changed. Because the amazing thing about those experiments was that what it concluded was that all people have to do is fundamentally shift their perception to understand that they can do something.
Yep.
And that will actually affect their responses and the way they are able to shape the world around them. So there is actually a way out of it, but it just requires a little bit of thinking. And unfortunately, thinking, if not outlawed at this point, is certainly not something that's very much encouraged by the culture in oh so many ways.
Well, you know, and speaking of Walden 2, or another book that Skinner wrote, he talked about it. He said he would prefer that his slaves know that they were slaves, because if you have slaves that don't know they're slaves and they wake up, then they're going to be pretty pissed off. And so they prefer to know they're slaves, know that they're in this condition, and there's no way around it. I find that curious. But like you said, you know, sometimes I find myself in a bizarro world by the way people react to me, and I'm sure you've been in this situation yourself, where people hear that you may have said something or may have done something that may have drawn attention to yourself, and they completely freak out, whether it's where you haven't gotten your flu shot or why aren't you afraid of germs, and all of this fear being pumped into people's systems to the point where they do just sort of give up and just basically belly flop and turn over and get in the fetal position. And I think that experiment has gone a long way in Mao's China and Stalin's Russia. And to me, in our society, you know, it's basically kicking that football down the road. Basically they decide how far they're going to take it. And we just, you know, we just sort of lean on them. They know what's best. What's your opinion? What's your take on that?
Well, it's exactly right. And it's important to understand this from a lot of different perspectives, but including the cultural perspective and history, because when you talk about Stalin or you talk about Mao, you're talking about cultural histories that were embedded in those particular geopolitical specific contexts. So you have the Russian peasants who suddenly found themselves as Bolshevik peasants, basically, and or you had the people in China who have a different concept of harmony versus individuality than has existed in Western societies. And those, again, those types of cultural contexts usually aren't given the same type of weight or status when people are trying to think about history, but I think they're absolutely important in terms of the way that people are able to respond. And I think we have to appreciate and understand the sort of Western mindset and the different things that have shaped Western jurisprudence and the Magna Carta and thinking about the Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence, and a very different history about individuals trying to assert more and more of their rights against the people who presume to rule over them, and the different ways that we justify having government rule over us at all, and things like that. So I think we're coming from a fundamentally different context than those societies. So from the viewpoint of a social engineer, you know, one of these technocrats, one of these B.F. Skinners or H.G. Wells's the Huxley's Julian specifically, who was the president of the British Eugenics Society, et cetera, those types of people have, I think, been thinking for a long time about how best to implement those types of slave societies, which they see as a utopia. Because, again, they know what's best, and they know how best to distribute everything and how everyone should act. So they know how to perfectly engineer the society, so any sort of resistance to that is a bad thing. Therefore, slavery is their ideal. But how do you implement that in a society that has that rich history of individual freedoms and the Western jurisprudence and habeas corpus and all these things that we've had for literally going on for a millennium until along comes Obama and Bush and people like that to try to destroy them all? And it's an interesting question, but unfortunately we're entering an age where this is becoming a technological question, and we're talking about eventually being able to manipulate people down to the level of the genome, and really and truly in the next century we're going to start having to face questions that humanity has never faced before about what it even means to be human. And I'm optimistic ultimately, because I have to be, because if I didn't think there was a chance of stopping or reversing this tide, I wouldn't be doing this at all. But absolutely, the level of ignorance of the vast majority of the public of some of these issues is, well, it gives me pause for concern at any rate.
Well, I think America is coming from a background of a philosophy of freedom and individualism. And you know, you talked about Skinner, B.F.F. Skinner, and Walden too. Another one of his buddies from the Leipzig school was Dewey. And of course, Dewey created our modern day educational system based off the behavioralism controlled response model. And we've just basically been whittling away our abilities to combat that. And you talked about the idea of what it means to be human, and you know, basically attacking the core of our humanity. And you know, I was actually recently, I was watching on Netflix, there was a movie called Zenith. I think everybody should check it out. Basically, it was about how in a modern society, I think 2020, 2040, everyone is genetically engineered to be happy. And what happens is people become numb and really kind of in the doldrums. And what they do is give themselves pain, and the pain is the only way they feel alive. Do you think that the life extension technologies and you know, all the nanotechnologies and all these different things that they're doing right now to lengthen people's lives, you know, synthetic biology, do you think that eventually that these people want to become like God, kind of a Mormon/Scientology type philosophy?
That's exactly where this is all going. And again, when you just say that to people, the vast majority of people just don't have the historical context or the understanding to see where that's coming from. So again, it usually takes a lot of background and filling in with the background of this in order to get people to even understand that these types of technologies are coming down the line. But once you get to that point and you start encountering such things as, of course, Aldous Huxley's 1962 speech at Berkeley, the final revolution, where he's talking about the types of things that he was writing about in Brave New World, and he's saying, well, they're kind of already here, and we're already dealing with them. We can already implant chips in people's brains that can affect their emotions and things like this. And really, I mean, we're looking at an age where the dictators of the future will be able to make their slaves happy to be slaves, and that's exactly what you're talking about there. And again, this is becoming more and more of a reality as we get into these technologies. So the way I see it is, it's something that recurs a lot in the types of well, fiction that they like to cloak a lot of their ideas in. So H.G. Wells, for example, is known as a science fiction author and War of the Worlds and things like that. But a lot of people don't understand that he was actually a key figure in the Fabian socialist movement. He was a key eugenicist. He wrote a lot of important documents, including the draft of the UN Charter of Human Rights. A lot of people don't know his real background and what an important political player he was. But of course, embedded in some of his works were some very interesting things, including in The Time Machine, where he wrote about the Morlocks and the Eloys. Basically, in the future, the human race splits into two, and there's the ape-like beings that live underground and do all the work, and then there's the perfect golden Aryan race that lives above ground, basically. And that's truly a vision of the future that pops up again and again, and it's something that I cite a lot. I should really find this article, but back in 2007 there was an article on BBC News of all places talking about how scientists were talking about how the human race was going to start diverging into two.
Yes,
absolutely. They had pictures of these, you know, ape-like beings and these, you know, alien-like beings that were going to evolve and devolve into, and I think that's really the vision of the future as we have it today, because we have the promise of these life extension technologies manipulating our genome and manipulating our merging with machines in all sorts of different ways as brain chips and all sorts of things become possible. But of course, that technology will only be implemented in ways that things are distributed in our current economy. So we have the haves and have nots. We're soon going to have that at a genetic level. We're going to have that in terms of intelligence when we start interfacing with the machines more, to the point where there will be a certain crop of people who have, you know, the special access to this technology, who will be so far advanced from the rest of us that they will start to become a different species in every respect.
You're absolutely right. I was talking to Charles Osman, a really great guy who works for NASA, also worked for DARPA as well. He said that, yeah, there'll be haves and there'll be have-nots, and, you know, that some people will be smarter in school because of the technology and some won't. What do you think about the most recent talk about people in the military actually merging with their weapons to their minds?
Well, I don't know specifically what story you're talking about, but I've certainly seen my share of stories over the past several years that I've been looking at this, of all the different ways that they want to engineer the perfect soldier. So we've seen all sorts of proposals for basically mind-controlling drugs that will be able to keep soldiers going for long periods of time without sleep or food and all of these types of things. And again, it sounds like science fiction, but it's getting closer and closer to reality with each passing day. And again, that to me is the fundamental point of this, because there are the H+, the World Transhumanist Association, that all of these people who say that this is going to be some perfect utopia where, of course, all of humanity will be great because of all of these upgrades that we'll be able to have and will be even better than humanity. We'll all be living as these godlike creatures. But of course, it will start to filter out through the military for. First of all, as always happens with new technologies, the military always has it first, and it's developed with public funds and used for that imperial takeover of the world. And we see that again with the development of the drone technologies, which is getting more and more creepy by the day, if you've seen some of the latest drone technologies that they're showing to the public. And again, it starts out with there, and it'll filter down to the very, very rich people. But again, it really does create the question: once these technologies start having the effects that we know that they're capable of, once nanotechnology starts engineering people down at the microscopic level, it's absolutely unthinkable the difference between these types of enhanced people and the regular people like you and me. And you can bet that Bill Gates and Ted Turner and all these people who talk constantly about the problem of overpopulation probably aren't concerned about the plight of the average person in India or in Africa who are starving to death and just trying to scrape by on a dollar a day. I think it's pretty safe to say that this type of technology is never going to filter down to that level.
I'll give an example. Prince Charles said, I think this is in BBC and Independent, he said that he had found the perfect model for society in their housing, which was a shanty town in Mumbai. If that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about their sort of, you know, ideologies and philosophies on life, I think eventually, well, when they start making what they're doing now, like the Manhunter drone, the Navy Manhunter drone, where drones are autonomous and there's like zero accountability, and getting really pilots. So basically, the outsourcing pilots and military all together now. I mean, everything will be completely, you know, based upon AI driven. They call it bootstrap learning, learning like a child does. You know, the way that they're intervening in these nations now, just willy-nilly, I really do fear for the fact of what will happen in the 22nd century. You know, where it doesn't matter what people say, it doesn't matter what the rule of law is, it doesn't matter what national sovereignty is. Do you think that the idea of national sovereignty now is dead because of all these military interventions?
It's, if not dead, it's dying. But I would venture to say that it's becoming an anachronism in this day and age. And unfortunately, there's no way to get that back, because they've again set up the system where the only way to think about the opposition here is to say, well, then what we need is a better type of global system. We don't want their type, but we should have our type. So I mean, they've left it in a situation where it's difficult to see the way forward. But to my mind, what we're battling on so many different fronts is a centralization of power and a centralization of control. Precisely. So decentralization has to be the way forward. And I think instead of looking at these types of overarching global organizations that will supposedly save us from all of this, the UNs of the world and all of that, I think what we really need to be doing is having a renaissance of understanding that in this day and age, especially as the average person like myself here in Japan is able to connect to you in the United States and blast out our message to people all over the world listening on little portable devices that cost them, you know, a few hours' wages. I mean, it's an incredible world to be living in. And that, to me, speaks to the power that the individual has now to connect to people all around the world. Exactly.
Absolutely.
I think we can devolve structures of government, devolve down to the local level, and really, I mean, get away from this idea that we have to go towards these centralized systems and more towards decentralized. And you can think of that in every single level, from geopolitical to economic to even things like obviously online communities, which are, again, I mean, it's truly starting to shape the world. And it's a question of whether we let them define the parameters of that, or if we take it into our own account.
Well, you look at countries like Russia during you know, Lenin's reign. You know, essentially they destroyed all money, they destroyed all industry. Everything was owned by the state. Complete collapse, famine. Okay, you know, barbarism and cannibalism happened because of this. And what was the result because of this was because of super centralization of power. An interesting person, the former Assistant Secretary General of the UN, wrote a document called Paradise Earth, and he said that what they want to have, their dream was to have planetary management. They want to have the UN in a position to be like Starfleet of Star Trek. I mean,
yes,
I mean,
and you'll notice that the United Federation of Planets and everything borrows its symbology from the UN quite
precisely.
Quite,
yeah, it's almost like, you know, basically pre-programming, predictive programming, taking you down that road. If you keep seeing it over and over again, you might just like it. For a moment, put your goggles on and look into the future here. James, do you think that we'll get our act together and sort of take on some of these new ideas and philosophies of freedom and individuality and push it forward? Or do you think the new technocrats of the world, and of course they call themselves technocrats now in the EU, do you think that they will try to hold power and keep it away with legislation, you know, basically monitoring Twitter and the internet and the like? Do you think that humanity will push it forward and improve our lives? Or do you think that the technocrats will use technology to their benefit?
Well, again, as I say, I have to believe that we'll be able to take it back. And because if I didn't think there was some way to do that, I wouldn't be here talking. I'd just be curled up in a ball waiting for the end to come. So there's got to be some way. You know, there's got to be some way for us to be able to do that, but it's definitely not going to be easy. And another thing that I think is important to understand is that this isn't some sort of battle that we'll win and that will be it for forever.
Oh, no.
And, you know, I think a lot of people get into that mindset where there's going to be some big climactic battle and everything will be over after
it's
that.
It's a scrimmage. That's exactly what it is, scrimmage. I mean,
it's exactly right. It's a war of attrition. And the first person to basically blink or to lie down is going to lose. And we see that in every front. I mean, for example, with the internet censorship legislation like SOPA and PIPA, of course, yes, when the people stand up and there's a huge mobilization against it, they'll back down, absolutely. But it's not like they're going to just go away. We see that coming up in all sorts of different ways. Of course, when SOPA and PIPA were big stories, ACTA was getting no attention, even though it had already been ratified.
I was just about to say that, James. You know, it was almost like, okay, let's blink on ACTA, which was, you know, bigger and wider and expansive than SOPA and PIPA ever was, and we'll make this big deal out of that while ACTA sort of slides through, you know, in the EU and whatnot. But
even regardless of that, we saw the day after the SOPA blackout, they seized megaupload.com, which goes to show they didn't need SOPA and PIPA to do that. They don't need this legislation. They already claim to have. Exactly. So. So again, I mean, it's a question. It's never going to stop. I think people have to be prepared to basically be vigilant for eternity. I think it's very true. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And I think a lot of people can't quite get that through their head that it's not going to stop. It just means that we have to be eternally vigilant and to never let go, because there will always be, regardless of the individuals involved at this point in time, if they were all to suddenly drop dead tomorrow, there would be another group to take their place instantaneously. It's a battle with human nature. And I don't think that battle's ever going to end. I think that's just a part of humanity and what we have to deal with. But again, there can be periods of pendulum swinging from one side to the other, from freedom to tyranny. And I'd like to think that we're on a freedom trajectory of that. Even though things are getting demonstrably darker in a lot of ways when we look at the NDAA and ACTA and all of these various pieces of legislation by which the powers that shouldn't be presumed to rule over the people, I think there still is that fundamental hope that is represented for me, I think, most clearly by the internet, which is not just a technology. I think it's a new way of communicating with other human beings, which in and of itself brings forward new things to communicate. That was one of the things that really sparked such an incredible revolution in Europe in the Middle Ages when Gutenberg invented the printing press, the movable type printing press, or coalesced all of the various technologies and put it into sort of one form for the first time. That sparked so many different revolutions, including bringing literacy to the masses, bringing the Bible to the masses, sparking the Reformation. It had so many effects on society that I think we're only beginning to comprehend how the internet is going to shape the 21st century. And again, as I like to say, this is a game for all the marbles, because as I said, the dictators of the future will have technologies at their beck and call, which dictators of the past could only have dreamed about. So I don't think we can ever let it get to that point again. It's like nuclear war. If you ever let it start, that's the end of humanity. So we just cannot let that happen. And as I say, I think the internet is the tool and the technology that we can use to really start to unite humanity in a way that's just never been possible before in history.
Well, I'm in agreement with you. I kind of look at it like, you know, the NDAA and SOPA and PIPA and ACTA. I look at it as controlled response, okay? They see our response to all of these legislations, all these different things going on, whether it's the Patriot Act. We don't like that. We make our voices heard. Things are done, and you know, we move forward, and like you said, a war of attrition, a scrimmage game. And really, I think that once the populace, you know, thinks things are well in hand, then they begin to sort of put things back on cruise control autopilot. It's like the guy who, you know, who got a brand new RV, got on the highway and you know, rode out. And he said, well, I'll put it on autopilot, and I'll go back in the back in the cabin and make a pot of coffee. Of course, the car rode off the ditch. Because, you know, of course, cruise control is not autopilot. And a lot of people think that, well, if things are fine, then we can leave things alone and we can go back to whatever we were doing and, you know, love and everything else. Then of course, the war of attrition, the scrimmage, they begin to take the field and advance to keep the football down the field. You know, we have to be, like I said, forever vigilant. You know, it doesn't mean we have to go get the guns and start the shooting and whatnot. I think that's kind of crazy. But
absolutely. And let me be clear about that. I'm not saying that that's where I think things are going to go, exactly, or where they should go, because ultimately I think we lose in that event. I think violent revolutions never really seem to have the intended outcome, and they generally only benefit the people who are in power. I think really and truly the only revolution that matters is a revolution of perception, a revolution of consciousness, a revolution of the mind, which goes back to that earlier point about learned helplessness versus learned optimism. And there is a way for us to truly start to affect change in ways that we can't even begin to imagine, simply because we change our perception of what we're capable of doing. And that's not just I know that sounds like just a pocket full of hope to a lot of people out there who are of the pessimistic variety, but honestly, I mean, this is something that comes out of this entire field of research of cognitive theory of psychology, that people truly are capable of doing things that they wouldn't otherwise be, simply by shaping their perception of the problem.
And also, I think, you know, the will is kind of like a muscle, you know. After a while, let's say you've been in a hospital for a long time, your muscles don't move properly, they atrophied and whatnot, and will is kind of like that too, you know. And once we sort of bring the will on, and we have the will to do things, and we flex our muscles, then we'll get stronger and stronger. And America has been like that, and a lot of other countries has been like that, to have the will to change things when we know that they're wrong. When they're fundamentally wrong, we have the will to change things, and I hope we do. And James, I appreciate the conversation, and I know that the listeners and the people at the Corbett Report and StratRisk.com will too, man. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And once again, I just hope that everyone out there takes this message and runs with it, because I'm not trying to be up on a high horse telling people what to do. I'm just trying to show some of the information that I think is important. So it's up to everyone out there to take it on board and do what they can with it.